As he heads back to his seat there, I want to take a minute and just say a word of thanks. I'm grateful every single week for the great music that Peter plays and offers us. Peter, you are very gifted, and we are very grateful. We really are blessed to have such passion and heart behind the keys of the piano. I mean, I've worked with a lot of different musicians and all sorts of levels of talent and how fancy a piece they can play. And let me tell you, not only does Peter play very well, but the heart and passion that you put into the music and your connection to what happens in this space means the world. And I'm very grateful for that. And I name that because I want you to know that asking Rick to come play the organ is not a reflection on Peter and his ability to do a good job with our hymns. It's just that the timbre and the tune of the organ, the vibrations that fill the room, they do something the piano alone can't. And so today, as we focus on what are some of the most often named old favorite hymns, it seemed a good week to fire up those billows and shake the dust out of the pipes. The hymns that were chosen for today, particularly Old Rugged Cross and How Great Thou Art, that we'll sing to close the service, these are hymns that have topped the list of favorite hymns for decades. The only hymn that makes the list higher than those consistently is Amazing Grace, and I get that. But these hymns, Old Rugged Cross and How Great Thou Art and others that we love, that these older hymns have such beautiful imagery. They tell powerful stories, and they carry meaningful messages. They also make use of strong biblical imagery for us to engage. In How Great Thou Art, that we'll sing in a little bit, it's amazing that the way it paints the beauty of the earth, it actually reminds us of the psalmists. In fact, so many of our hymns echo the psalms because the psalms were the first hymns of the tradition. Mind you, within the Hebrew church, that was what was sung. They weren't just read. It was chanted and echoed and shared together in Hebrew. And now we carry those psalms into the Christian tradition as well, and so it would make sense that so many of our hymns would echo the messages and feel of those first early psalms. How Great Thou Art as a hymn parallels the acknowledgement of the psalms, and it happens throughout all of our psalms, but Psalm 19 is a great example, where the psalmist just stops and even just attempts to take in the beauty and wonder of creation. And in an attempt to do so, suddenly finds themselves in awe of God's work. Hear it as the psalmist says in Psalm 19. Heaven and earth are declaring God's glory. The sky proclaims the Lord's handiwork. One day gushes the news to the next. One night informs the other of all there is to be known. Of course, there's no speech and no words. Their voices can't be heard. But their sound, the sound of nature, extends throughout the world. Their words are reaching the very end of the earth, proclaiming God's greatness. It's powerful words. And I'll tell you, such splendor and the ability of the natural world to leave us without adequate words is not hard to find or preach on in Colorado. There are some other places I will not name, but I wonder how they get into those psalms and really fully appreciate it. But I tell you, the reality of witnessing this beautiful word and finding myself where suddenly my soul begins to sing, it's something that can be experienced. You can encounter it watching the sunset, or perhaps just admiring the beautiful mountain range as it changes varying shades of purple depending how far those peaks are away from you. Or maybe even in the stillness and the quiet of a late night snowfall. These are moments the wonder of this world can leave us in awe of how great God truly is. How Great Thou Art moves from those natural images into the gospel narrative, walking us through the story of Christ's life and death, reminding us of the greatness of God's love. Now, using the gospel story to remind us of God's love is a theme that is visited again in Old Rugged Cross. We just sang the words and heard the story. In Old Rugged Cross, we are invited to reflect on a symbol that has become so common it can be easily overlooked. I know. Feelings are real. So here's the thing. The cross was a show-stopping, conversation-starting implement of death in Jesus' time. And now it adorns necklaces and earrings and stylized tattoos and bumper stickers. something shifted. What Old Rugged Cross as a hymn is trying to remind us is that the cross was an emblem of suffering and shame when Christ was put upon it. Now, that's not that we should be ashamed of the cross. It's just a reminder that this was not a symbol you wore on things to try to show you were a part of a special group. The author of Old Rugged Cross was actually a Methodist evangelist, and he was bothered by all of the gold crosses that adorned sanctuaries and people's homes of his day. He would step in and he would see these shiny, beautiful objects, and for him, that didn't convey the message that he saw in the gospel. And so he thought about the old rugged cross and wrote the hymn we just sang. He felt that if its true message was lost, the story would be passed by. I mean, the cross as a symbol has carried many different meanings to various Christian traditions throughout time. For those that might have a Catholic background, the crucifix has the body of Jesus on the cross, displayed to remind those who see it of Christ's suffering and death. The empty cross, used outside the Catholic tradition in Protestant churches, is empty, just like the tomb was empty, to remind us of the resurrection. There's no right or wrong answer in this conversation. In fact, it's the fullness of the story, the entire life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus, what the hymn is trying to invite us to remember. To remember the story. And it's an important one. When I was in college, I spent 3 years reading a single book. It wasn't for class. In fact, I was enough of a church nerd that I wanted to start reading some church books on my own. And so I got myself a copy of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship. And it sat on my nightstand, slowly being read for 3 years. Now, when I can sit and read other books casually at like 100 pages an hour, I could only get through Bonhoeffer at 8 to 10 pages an hour. I'd sit and I'd read and I'd have to go back and I'd be like, wait, and I'd have to flip back again. I'd have to have a dictionary sitting next to me at the time because you couldn't just touch your Kindle and have the definitions pop up. It was painstaking. But I wanted to spend some time reading it because it was a theological masterwork. And for all of the difficulty I had reading it, there was one concept that was very, very clear. What God did in Jesus matters. What God did in Jesus matters. But too often, it's not valued. Bonhoeffer wrote about a concept of cheap grace and costly grace. That grace should not be cheap in our minds, that it should be valued. And I would wrestle with his ideas and read and read and then reread and then reread and try. And finally, it clicked for me. Not because of his beautiful and powerful writing, but because of my bicycles. So when I was about 5 years old, my parents bought me my first bike. It was shiny and red and had training wheels on it and went really fast. Okay, my parents could walk next to me while I rode it, but in my mind, it went really fast. And I love it. I'd hop on it, and I'd ride my bike around the neighborhood. Then I'd get home and want to do something else. I would just take my bike, toss it in the yard, and go about my day and play other things. Then I would come back, find it in the yard, hop on it, play a little bit more riding around, then just toss it in the yard again, and just leave it laying there and go about my day. There was one day I wandered back to pick up the bike that I'd hastily just discarded laying there in the yard, and it wasn't there. And it wasn't anywhere else either. Someone had stolen my bike. It wasn't gone forever. A few weeks later, it showed up again covered in mud and twigs and those little green things that grow in rivers because someone had taken it and tossed it in the stream a few blocks away from the house. Some of the neighbor kids found it and were like, isn't this Brad's? He should take better care of it. Fast forward a few years to when I was in eighth grade. My family had just moved to Colorado, and like any eighth grader who has just moved to Colorado, I knew I needed a mountain bike. That's what eighth graders in Colorado need, mountain bikes. But I was at an age where that wasn't just going to happen. I had to do work for it. I had to earn the money for it. I had to pick up extra chores. I had to save. I did not spend my money on other things until I saved enough money to go to the bike store. And then at the requirement of my father, sit there with a yellow legal notepad marking all the different models and which features they had and which ones I really thought I needed. And eventually picked out the perfect bike. It was a Trek XL 830. I still know exactly which model it was. And it was purple, and it faded into green, and I got a matching helmet, And when I took that bike home, oh man, every time I rode it, I would take it back in and gently wash it down and make sure it was clean. I bought the finest lock money could buy for that bicycle. Oh man, I even got off it for a second. It was locked up and polished and always well taken care of. And there was a difference. Because with the second bike, with that one I bought myself, I knew how much it was worth. I'd put in the energy. I'd put in the time. I'd put in the sacrifice. And it meant something to me, and I valued it in a way I had never valued something before. Thinking back, I actually start to ponder the hard work my parents put in to buy me a bike, having just bought one for my own kiddo. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of things they didn't do for themselves. That's all, you know how all those things add up, and as a kid, you don't think about it. You don't even realize the effort and the time and all those same things going into getting something for me. This is the difference between cheap grace and costly grace. When I knew what it cost, it received my attention, it received my effort, and I valued it. And this is how Bonhoeffer invites us to see the cross, just like the hymn. It invites us to see it as a demonstration of how invested God is in us. Bonhoeffer phrased it this way, quoting 1 Corinthians as well. Above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his Son. As it is written in Scripture, ye were bought at a price. And what has cost God much cannot be cheap to us. We are invited to cherish the old rugged cross, not to feel guilt, not to feel shame, but to feel valued, to feel our own worth, to feel invested in. Because you are worthy of God's great love. You are cherished in that way. As we sing all these songs today, I tell you, the hymns carry with them so much more than just the music notes or the words. They carry something deeper within them. These hymns, especially ones that might be old favorites for some of us, they remind us to find a song to carry in our hearts. For some of us, it's a connection to the people who sang them with us that are no longer around. Sometimes it's a connection to the places they were sung, places we grew up listening and hearing them. For others, it's simply the message of the text, words that we see written out that we want to feel and know to be true, so we keep singing them until it feels real. Actually, well, I visited a friend's house this week, a clergy colleague of all things, Reverend Lucia Guzman, and I was stopped by, and there were hymns playing at her house, and she's like, I promise I didn't put those on because you were coming over. And I was like, sure. She goes, but since they're on, hey, what's your favorite hymn? I was like, ooh, I should know this. I'm preaching on hymns right now. And so I told her, I said, okay, out of the old hymnal, O for a thousand tongues to sing. But out of the new hymnal, draw the circle wide and don't make me choose between the two. I want you to think about this question. What are the songs that make your soul sing? I invite you to find hymns that speak to you, that cause not just your voice, but your soul to join into a chorus of life. And I tell you, if we don't sing your favorite song often enough, you let me know. I'll work on it. You know, one of my dear friends and mentors is a music director at a church. In fact, we actually were on staff together for a number of years. And there was a day I was going to do a hospice visit. A member of our church was approaching the end of their physical life, and I was going along, and he said, can I come with you? And I was like, sure, that sounds great. And so we went to the hospice to sit bedside alongside a dying member of our congregation and their family. And I did the usual things I do. I offered the blessings and I said the prayers and held hands and anointed with oil. And then my buddy Jim opened the hymnal he'd brought with him. And he looked at the family and asked what the dying man's favorite hymns were. And then sitting alone next to the bed, no music to accompany him, he began to sing those songs. And it changed the way I do pastoral care. He shared the songs that made their soul sing, and it was beautiful. And now I don't visit the dying without my hymnal in hand. It's something I do whenever I'm offered the chance. And on more than one occasion, I have watched bodies that have not responded to anyone in days begin to mouth along to the hymns that they held in their hearts their entire lives. I have watched nearly comatose lips begin to join a chorus of life as the music that resides deep in who they are fills the room. You have that place too. You do. It's a space in each of us that holds on to this melody of hope of the songs that mean something to us. Scientists can point on a brain map to the parts that music activates that nothing else does. And as a pastor, I may not have a brain map to point to, but I can tell you there is a part of your soul that holds special music, whatever it is for you, in ways that care for who you are. And I invite us to hold and cherish those things, not just for when life nears its end, but those songs and the hope that they carry and the way they can affect us matter just as much, not just at the end of life, but when we reach the end of our rope and when we're pushed to our emotional limits and when we feel empty and burned out. When we're in those places, our souls can find those songs and they can sing again. For they are songs that remind us of our worth and recall God's love for who we are. That's the invitation of an old favorite hymn. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art.